I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Over the last couple of years, Lisa Smedman from the Vancouver Courier has written two marvelous books on Vancouver history. The first from 2008 was Vancouver Stories of a City, which looked at the city's neighborhoods and the people whose names are attached to them, who they were and what they wrought. The book's publication coincided with the Courier's 100th anniversary and sold well. The latest is Immigrants, Stories of Vancouver's People. This book tells the stories of the different immigrant groups who've come here, who've added much to the city we know today. We're not spared the less than stellar moments in our history as well. Lisa Smedman joins me now. She is a prolific writer, having written some 16 novels as well as a number of children's books. She has been at the Courier since 1998. Writing the Histories Lens column there, where these books have been born out of. She's a game designer and teaches at the Art Institute of Vancouver. Her website for more is lisasmedman.topcities.com. You can order Immigrants and the previous book directly from the Courier's website. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Lisa Smedman. Good morning, Ms. Smedman.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Thanks for joining us. We're such fans of your pieces in the Courier, I guess a lot of people were, and that's why these books came about, right?
That's right, yeah. As you mentioned, I have a regular column called History's Lens, and what I would do is invite readers to get in touch with me if they had old photographs that they wanted. Sometimes they knew the story behind, sometimes they didn't know the story behind them, and then I would wrap a bit of a column around them, publish the photo, and talk a little bit about what it means, its place in history.
And a lot of the photos that you've seen in the column and that are in this book, we haven't seen previously, right?
That's correct. While there are quite a few photos from archives and libraries, a number of the photos in both of the books came from individuals who came forward when I put out the call to say that I was doing a book about immigration to Vancouver, and they've shared not only their stories, but their photographs as well. So in some cases, it's a photo of grandparents or even great-grandparents. In other cases, it's a photo of the individual themselves at the time that they immigrated, and they can tell me a first-person story about what it was like to come from whichever the countries they've come from.
Did the reception that the stories got in the paper and the first book, did that surprise you?
Yes and no. I'd gotten a good response to History's Lens over the years. The reception was very good to the first book and to the second book. Lots of people have stories that didn't make it into the book, particularly with the second book. I was still getting telephone calls and offers of photos and stories from people long after we'd finished the project and sent the book off to the printers. And there were, you know, many, many stories to tell that I would have dearly loved to have included in the book, and other nationalities as well that I would have loved to include in the book and simply ran out of time and space.
Well, as a historian, what do you think we should do with the photos we have today? I mean, we're taking probably a lot more photos than people did before, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so certainly. There's a wealth of photos today. But even going back to the time of, say, you know, your parents, you know, maybe the 60s, the 70s, that kind of era, where there are a lot of photographs, what people often fail to do is write down just the simple thing of writing down who's who in those photos.
Yeah.
Because it goes down a generation or two, and you know that this person's somehow related to me, but was it, you know, my aunt? Was it just a friend of my mom? Who knows? That context, that vital context is lost. So certainly, you know, from a historical perspective, having the information of when the photo was taken, even the decade it was taken, and who's in it, is just so vital.
And someone you talk about in both books is Major Matthews,
mm-hmm.
James Skint Matthews. The I guess he was Vancouver's first archivist, right?
That's correct. And he collected just an amazing wealth of stories that I sprinkle throughout both books. He, starting in the 1930s, he sat down each of the pioneers of the city, anyone who'd come in the 1870s, the 1880s, the 1890s, and so on, and took down their stories. He'd have them recite their story, and then he'd type it up and get them to sign off on the story as being accurate. And these are all preserved in a a collection of seven really thick volumes down at the Vancouver Archives, City of Vancouver Archives, and will in the future be digitized so anyone can read through them and flip through them. But there's some amazing first-person stories that we otherwise simply wouldn't have of what it was like to come to Vancouver that far back when at a time when Vancouver was a little sawmill town, population 300.
I once had Daphne Slay on the program, the woman who did the biography of Matthews.
Right.
And Jean Berman, she was on with her book on Stanley Park Secret, and she talked about just how consequential he was to capturing the early history of Vancouver, but as you said, by talking to these pioneers. Who's doing what he did now? Like, who's taking down our stories?
There's a lot of local oral history projects. I couldn't cite any specifically, but they pop up from time to time at community centers, and people will sometimes have a particular focus, like women's history of a particular area. Other times it'll just be a catch-all. You find, out of the community centers, a lot of seniors groups, seniors getting together to write down their memoirs and polish them up a little bit. The archive certainly does continue to collect information. In recent years, they've had a bit of a push on to collect more of the history of the early Chinese immigrants to Vancouver. They were very well stocked, let's say, in terms of European immigrants, but were lacking a little bit in terms of immigration from Asia. And they've plugged a number of those gaps. There's a wonderful collection of letters, one of which that I include transcribed in the book, Immigrant Stories of Vancouver's People. And it's a letter, there were a number of letters that were written back and forth. People would come from China, perhaps as contract laborers or, you know, strictly to come and try and make their mark in Vancouver. And letters would go back and forth, and there was a company that served as sort of an informal post office, a clearinghouse for all these letters, and several of them were just never claimed. And we have those today, a huge, very interesting collection of letters that are both letters from the homeland saying, "Hey, Dad, what's happened to you? Are you well?" And letters that were intended to go back to the homeland from the immigrants talking about their experiences here.
And it must have been neat just to go through stuff like that. Was it?
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm both ends of the equation are interesting. The book starts out in the 1850s and runs right up to the 1990s, and I'm looking at some of the more recent immigrant groups. So with the more recent groups, it's interesting to hear the stories firsthand from the people who live them. It's also fascinating for me as a historian to hold in my hands, for example, there's a diary in the archives that dates from 1833, and it's by a fellow who immigrated from Scotland, and he talks about what it was like to come to Canada on a sailing ship, and he's talking about the storms and everybody down in the, you know, steerage below decks being ill, and then the days on end being becalmed when the winds weren't blowing properly, and what's kind of neat is to look at these accounts and realize there's commonalities, whether you're, you know, coming from sailing ship in the 1830s or you're coming on a plane from Italy in the 1960s, there's commonalities when you look at the journeys. They tend to go through the same sorts of things, the issues with the language and, you know, who's gone on ahead of us, who are we going to stay with when we arrive, and how are we going to fit in.
And I guess immigrant groups have been coming to the city forever, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were originally, you know, Vancouver area was originally a collection of Squamish and Musqueam First Nations villages, and in the 1860s, we finally get a sawmill and happening in terms of immigration from Europe, which most people think of as immigration, and as I say, you know, a very small sawmill town, population 300, springs up.
Are there new communities coming today?
Oh, certainly. You're seeing a changing face to immigration. The phenomenon of Chinese immigration, for example, really starts to pick up in the 80s. Of course, in the early periods, Chinese were deliberately excluded and deterred from coming by things like the head tax and the Exclusion Act. And then things loosen up a little bit, but things really get going in the 80s, and we really see a changing face to the city. from that point on. And certainly there are, you know, the things that motivate people to leave their homelands, either voluntarily or involuntarily, still continue today. There's still, you know, wars and civil strife and so on that erupt in the world, and people are fleeing that and you know, winding up in Vancouver as a result. So wherever conflict is breaking out in the world, in the, either during the conflict or in the aftermath when things calm down, you're finding an influx of people from that particular area.
Taking the Chinese group as an example, the attitudes that people have had towards the Chinese coming to this part of the world has changed over those 100 years, hasn't it? I mean, there was a view.
To a huge degree.
Yeah.
We had formal legislation that prevented people not only from China but from India, and particularly the Punjab, but people from India from coming as well. In the case of India, it was the Continuous Journey Act, which stipulated that you had to begin your journey in India and end it in Canada. And, of course, that wasn't possible. The people who drafted the legislation knew this. It was only possible to begin your journey in Hong Kong. So you'd take one leg of the journey by one steamship company and a second leg by a second steamship company, thus contravening the rules, so you weren't legally allowed into Canada. That law officially stood on the books for everybody, but they only imposed it for those coming from India, coming from the Punjab.
And I'm sort of thinking as well, like in at the time of the railroad, there was a lot of criticism that they were cheap labor. And now in the 90s, after around the Hong Kong thing, people were criticizing Chinese immigration to the area because they were driving property prices up higher. So it's interesting to see the attitudes there, of in the criticism that we get from these different groups. There's a story in the book about Dan On. Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
If you could share that, that'd be, that's just a fascinating story.
I include two stories of people who immigrated from Vietnam in the aftermath of the Vietnamese War. In the one case, an officer who flees immediately, and in the other case, Dan On. It's Dan's is a real rags-to-riches story. He comes as a teenager, and his is a story sort of that you'd hear repeated during the exodus of people from Vietnam that was known as the Boat People. Chinese ethnicity, Vietnamese nationality, has to get out. I won't go into all the political reasons for that, but the makes a journey on a very crowded ship, attacked by pirates. People survive literally by the skin of their teeth, and eventually he finds sanctuary in Canada. And as he says, he was born to be an entrepreneur, and anytime you pick up the nuts or dried fruits that are in dandy packs, that's his company. Built himself up, as I say, a real rags to riches story. Built himself up from nothing, you know, just arriving here as a teenager who didn't speak any English, and you know, now has you know, really made his mark on Vancouver.
Yeah, I saw a truck yesterday, and that's why it reminded me of the story in the book.
Yeah. But a fascinating story about how he, you know, he had, I think it was a few American dollars in hand, and when the pirates boarded their ship, you know, shoved it into a pair of jeans and shoved the pair of jeans into a corner, and so the money was overlooked, and so he managed to hang on to a little bit of something. But a number of the people who came from Vietnam had quite horrific journeys, you know, their boats being pushed back out to sea and people drowning and you know, terrible stories that come out of that time period.
How quickly do the have you found? I mean, can you sort of see how quickly these groups, once they come here, how soon it is before they're assimilated? How soon it is that they're voting or contributing, sort of politically even?
Depends on the time period of history we're talking about, because bear in mind that certain groups were excluded from voting and participating politically. But the sort of common pattern that you see, if we're talking about the whole 150-year range that I cover in the book, is the initial immigrants come over, you know, not speaking English typically, really having to work, you know, day and night to make a go of things. Their kids, if their kids are coming over early enough, tend to be the default translators for the family. The kids come up through the Canadian school system, and by the time you get down to the next generation, the grandchildren of the immigrants, they're absolutely fluent in English, absolutely Canadianized, although you know, with a strong roots in the motherland of their grandparents. But you know, starting to lose the language a little bit, not always speaking, you know, Punjabi or Mandarin or whatever the language might be, and really, I would say by the time you get to the grandchildren of the folks who have immigrated, they're really thoroughly assimilated and Canadianized, albeit, you know, with traditions that still carry through.
People still contact you with photos and stories, do they?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I was recently down at the library doing an exhibit on women's history, part of a larger group of exhibitors, and people were still coming up and sharing stories with me that I thought, oh, wish I could have gotten that into the book. That would have been great.
Is there another book?
Not at this point. I'm mulling around a few ideas, so we'll see. We'll see. Certainly, yeah. I've got, you know, enough stories collected over the many years. I think I started my History's Lens back in 2003, so it's been quite a few years I've been doing this.
Yeah. There's a chapter in the book, other than the groups that you specifically talk about, on train travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I included that because a number of times I had original documents to work from, you know, handbooks for immigrants, you know, what to expect when you get here, what they're going to pay you, how to fit in if you're used to cooking different foods and you want to work as a domestic worker. In the case of Cross Canada by Train, the arrival of the transcontinental train to this coast and to Vancouver specifically being chosen as the terminus for the railway, the CPR, has a real impact on how the city grows. I mean, without that, you know, without the train coming across, we'd still be a sawmill town, basically. And so in those early days, the first couple of years that the train was in operation, I had one diary from 1886 and another from 1887, and it describes the journey blow by blow coming across Canada, what the immigrant experience was. Because, of course, if you were coming from Europe back in the day, you would come across to Halifax or Quebec City and board the train, and across Canada you'd come. This was still the experience. Many years later, I interviewed people who came from Holland, post-war immigrants, a few of the war brides who came, who had married Canadian soldiers and come to Canada, and their experiences of coming across Canada by train in the late 40s had a number of parallels, you know, dealing with the kids on this lengthy journey, what do we do? And sort of, you know, the vastness of Canada, and oh my goodness, we hadn't expected this, you know, days and days on the train. But I really enjoy it when I get a hold of, you know, a first-person account, particularly these two that I do include from back in the day, because that was key to, that was a key chunk of a number of people's experience if you were immigrating during that time period in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, 1920s. My own paternal grandmother would have come across Canada by train. She came from Finland. So it's you can even read, you know, the 1880s accounts and see echoes of what your ancestors would have experienced, even if they came in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you do some of your research at the public library.
That's correct.
The archive, I guess that's by the planetarium, right?
Right.
Yeah. Are those places, are they good for those of us who aren't historians, who are just interested in some of the things that you write about, to go there and see some of perhaps exhibits or material there?
Oh, absolutely. They're very accessible. There are a number of smaller archives as well, devoted to Chinese history and Jewish history, Japanese history. I may be leaving some out, but those spring to mind immediately. And all of those, you know, go out of their way to help people who want to do a bit of research, either on the time period or perhaps on their own families. At the Vancouver Archives, there's a collection of city directories, so you can actually go, the equivalent of phone books, but they have a bit more to them than that. The listing for your particular ancestors, you can go and read through and find out where your grandfather, not only where your grandfather was living, but what he listed as his occupation in any given year. And you can sort of trace your family as it moves around Vancouver if that chunk of your history is not known to you or got lost along the way somehow.
Lisa, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. You know that I'm a big fan of the History's Lens column,
and
these two books. They're just tremendous, and I think you've done a great service. And because I'm sure that these books will be around for a very long time.
Oh, I hope so. Yes.
Yeah. The book is called Immigrant Stories of Vancouver's People. You can get that directly from the Courier's website, vancourier.com. Lisa Smedman, its author, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.